Mistral is France's national champion in AI. Will it make Europe a global contender for the technology in the years to come? Chris Hay is a distinguished engineer and CTO of customer transformation. Chris, welcome back to the show. What do you think?
The US is just following in Europe's footsteps.
All right, great. Volkmar Ulig is Vice President AI Infrastructure Portfolio Lead. Volkmar, what do you think?
I think the judgment is still out, but I hope the best for him.
All right, great. And Kautar El-Megrawi is a Principal Research Scientist and Manager for Hybrid Cloud Platform. Kautar, welcome back. What's your take?
I think Europe may not win the race to build the biggest model like what's happening in the US and China, but it has a big opportunity to still define the rules of the road.
All right, all that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a world-class team of researchers, engineers, and product leaders to discuss and debate the biggest news in artificial intelligence. As always, we have a ton to talk about. We're going to talk about a big shipment of chips to Saudi Arabia, some new releases in the world of benchmarking, and a new experiment around AI-generated ads. But first, I really want to talk a little bit about Mistral's Medium 3, which was a launch that happened just a few weeks back. It's part of a class of models that they've been working on for some time. They tout 8x lower cost and really kind of the opportunity to do on-premises deployment with this Mistral Medium series of models. And their tagline is Medium is the new large. And so I guess, Chris, maybe I'll start with you. You know, we haven't talked about Mistral on the show for quite a while. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to bring them back up again was obviously there's this new release, but it kind of offers the question of like, is Mistral still kind of a contender in this open source space? And curious about how you size that up.
I think so. I love Mistral, first of all. And to come back to my earlier point, right, the Mistral team were the original folks that came up with the Llama models in the first place, Llama 1. So they are great innovators. I love the Mistral models. I especially love the Mistral 7B from a few years ago. And I think the new Mistral Medium is great. But maybe the criticism I would give is that have we had that sort of 7-8B type model or even a 3B type model from them? They've been focusing on like, well, the Mistral Medium 3 is probably what, a 70 billion parameter model. Even their small model they released recently was a 24 billion parameter model. So when we think about the world that most open source developers live in, it is the world of Llama, it's the world of Hugging Face, and therefore you need the smaller models. So by not having those smaller models out there, they maybe just sort of fell out of our thinking a little bit, but what they're doing in the lab, so Mistral Medium 3 is a fabulous model. It's super fast. It really is state of the art. But again, another thing I would criticize is they haven't put a reasoning model with that as well. So as good as it is, we've all sort of moved on to reasoning models, and I think they just need to kind of push that. But I'm confident they're going to do some great stuff, and we're going to see a resurgence of them.
Yeah, for sure. Kautar, I'm curious if you agree. I mean, I think Chris is making a sort of interesting point, which is like, Medium is maybe still too large for a lot of what's happening in enterprise. You know, it kind of sounds like at least the story that Chris is telling is almost that they kind of like are sort of missing the boat on where the kind of current competition is and where the current heat is in the open source space. Do you think that becomes a problem for them going forwards?
I think so. Actually, you know, I think Mistral, what, you know, their strategy has been, you know, these open weights, they also focus on high performance, also the focus on the low inference cost, they all have been great. And while, you know, they haven't been making many headlines as OpenAI or Anthropic right now, I think their quiet consistency in releasing these strong open models is worth noting. So the Medium 3, for example, ranks competitively on standard leaderboards. And I think their commitment to the open source community is a very rare stance in today's increasingly closed, you know, ecosystem. So the question is, you know, has really Mistral faded from the race, or are they quietly building the foundations for long-term impact in the open weight AI ecosystem, which I think, you know, I think they're heading that way. Of course, like Chris mentioned, you know, they need to fix, you know, the reasoning aspect of their models, but I think they'll get there.
Yeah, for sure. Volkmar, I think one of the interesting parts about Mistral for me is that it feels like, you know, countries increasingly have like their big AI champion, right? So there's like DeepSeek in China and the US, arguably OpenAI, but a number of companies. And I think for a long time, Mistral really was kind of like the big hope of Europe and certainly of France. on the idea that they would have a national champion that'd be able to kind of like lift many boats and help build sort of an AI sort of kind of industry and sort of leadership for kind of the continent. I'm curious if you kind of buy that as a thesis. I know you said in your opening remarks that you said that you wish them all the best, which I guess the more critical way of saying that is you don't know if they must have like a very strong hope. But curious if you want to talk a little bit more about that.
Okay, that's a loaded question. if you look where GPUs get deployed, there's a very strong concentration in the States and in like a couple of countries which are trying, like we are talking about this with the Saudis. There's investment going on, but if you look at the majority of GPU deployment, it still happens in very, very few places in the world. Like, you know, the 50,000, 100,000 GPU clusters are pretty much only in the States. And so I think there's a concentration of capital and there's a concentration of skills, which is clearly not in Europe's advantage. Europe is really good at writing regulations right now, but they're regulating something which they cannot build themselves. And I think this is a real big danger. And so I think companies, like starting an AI company today in Europe, is kind of insane. Because like, you know, it's not understood market and already overregulated. And so I think Mistral is kind of like, you know, walking the line. I think in general, what we are going to see is that companies are going to focus on their local markets. If you look just from a language perspective, all these models are very English focused, and then all the other languages are almost translations. And so, the Chinese said, okay, we want to have a Chinese first model. And so I think there will be kind of local champions. I think also that we see a trend, you know, what you are saying, like medium is the new large, I would say, and small is the new medium. And every 6 months, that's the case. Right, so if you look at the capabilities of the models, what we could only do in huge models is now moving into something you can run on your laptop. But it took like 2 or 3 iterations. And so I think Mistral is just adopting to that general trend, you know, that the technology is now at a point that I don't need a 70B model anymore to get that type of performance. And it's just, you know, the nature of the beast. I think also the smaller models are just much more economic. And so there's economic pressure, right? The moment you deploy this at scale and you don't have money to burn anymore, then you need to actually look at what the cost footprint is. And I think that's probably a reaction of Mistral as well.
Like in some ways, like you have to be close to where the clusters are to build the talent and expertise.
Yeah. I think the capital follows the talent follows the capital. And so you are in a world where Europe just doesn't have deployment. And so the people who are really good, they come here. I mean, you need to go somewhere where someone is willing to pay for 50,000 GPUs. It's not happening in Europe.
Yeah, I think I second Volkmar's point. You know, Europe actually today where it's lagging is, you know, the compute infrastructure. So it's really the continent. What we see is it's really short of, you know, on the sovereign AI compute. There is no European equivalent of the AI 100 H100 scale clusters that you find in the US and even in China. There's also, I think, a lack in the VC funding. And so the startups in Europe today, they're struggling to access the scale of funding that fuels also Silicon Valley and to the Chinese tech ecosystems. That's also like these are like very, things that are kind of slowing their progress. And the foundation model development. So, you know, it doesn't have like a direct equivalent to OpenAI or Google DeepMind. So Mistral, you know, even if it's, you know, their champion, but like, you know, I think Volkmar pointed, you know, access to compute is very important. So you need to have both.
Chris, do you buy this? I mean, I think my note of skepticism is like, you know, we live in the 21st century, right? Like there's the internet, like the idea that you have to be kind of proximate to all the compute in order to build a strong AI industry. That, I guess, I know, works a little bit against my intuitions. But Chris, do you want to jump in?
I don't buy any of that in the slightest. Have we all got short-term memories or something? What were we saying about China, 6 months ago? And we're like, oh, US is the greatest. Well, China doesn't have access to any H100s. And then DeepSeek comes along and we all go, whoops. And I think that's the exact same case. I mean, let's look at what Mistral have done there, right? We're sitting arguing about Medium, but it's one of the strongest models that is out there that's non-reasoning. So they've shown that in the benchmarks. It is a great model. If you go and use it, it is a fantastic model, right? And again, I'm guessing at the 70 billion parameter model, but that's phenomenal what they've done. It's outperforming the Llama 4 Maverick model, for example. And we're saying, Europe, you're useless. Sorry, you just created one of the best models. And again, let's go back to being Europe for a second. Who is leading Google's Gemini model? Damis Hasbis, right? Where does he come from? Not America, right? If we look at OpenAI, who started that from an architectural point of view? Ilya Sutskever. Where did he come from? Not America, right? So there is lots of European innovation coming through. European companies are building stuff and they don't have access to AI clusters. Just write them off of AWS.
Maybe not the second part. Both part, do you want to get in?
Yeah, you just called out individuals. And if you look at the the top companies founded in the Bay Area, that is most like 50% or so is not from Americans, like American born. That's a non-argument, because what you're saying is like my birth citizenship matters. It's like, no, it matters where you actually build your company.
Okay, but let's take the Llama models who were built by France, right? That was that team that were doing that. So innovation is coming from Europe, right?
Hang on. Two things. Are the businesses, is there innovation? Europe has the brain power. Europe has no money to actually fund it. That's why it's all funded in the United States. If you look at the amount of capital which is spent in the US on new technology and the amount of capital spent in Europe, there's nothing spent in Europe. So, and therefore, I'm very happy we got a full brain drain. Let's take all these people and make it happen in the United States.
But we literally had this argument 6 months ago about DeepSeek, right? So I'm telling
that's
you.
That's a different story. Completely different.
I don't think it is.
I think so.
Do you not think it is?
Yes, because in one case, you have a wall and people cannot get out. And in the other case, you don't.
No, the DeepSeek, they have the GPUs, but they probably didn't have the latest, or top scale GPUs. But they were very clever in how do we, take those limits and even act at the PTX level of the CUDA, so they can basically overcome the limitation that they had. So I think there are two things here we're talking about. There is the brain power, and there is the infrastructure and the deployments. So the research, the R&D, yeah, it could come anywhere. But then when you want to deploy these things at scale and see the business value, that's, I think, where we see the lags.
So this is a very nice segment, or a nice segue into our next segment, actually. So it's another story I want to kind of bring up and have the panel react to, but I think it'll actually be a continuation of this discussion in some ways. Super interesting news coming out of Saudi Arabia this week. NVIDIA announced that it will be collaborating with the Saudi Investment Fund to build what they call AI factories. And they are projecting sort of the deployment of several hundred thousand advanced processors in Saudi Arabia over the next amount of time. And they're promising sort of a data center capacity of as much as, quote, 500 megawatts. The first step of this is going to be a shipment of 18,000 GB300 Grace Blackwell chips. And I think maybe Volkmar, just to maybe turn it to you first, because I know this is your world. Can you give me a sense of like, what is 500 megawatts compared to where we are today?
There are two viewpoints on this. That's a lot and it's nothing. Okay. If you take latest announced NVIDIA rack, that's a typical rack in a data center is about 20 kilowatts. If you're really trying to push the envelope, it's 30, 35, but that's kind of on the edge. So 20 kilowatts, if you take 500 megawatts, you do the math, it's thousands of racks. Now, if you look on the flip side of what NVIDIA announced with the next generation rack, which is a petaflop in a rack, it's 600 kilowatts per rack. Okay, so if you take your 500 megawatts, then you can fit 800 of these racks in a data center. Now, 800 racks is still a very large installation, but like if you look in the it's not 20,000 racks, right? So we are in a world where it's a sufficiently large deployment to actually make a dent. For a whole country, that's probably not enough.
Katar, one of the things we were talking about a little bit earlier, I guess, was kind of Volkmar's thesis that like the talent follows the capital. And so I guess maybe you could draw a comparison where you say, well, Europe's got the talent, but it doesn't have the capital. this seems to be a case where, you know, the Gulf states, they have the capital. And now the question is whether or not going to be able to bring sort of the talent to really build out a much broader AI kind of industry. Curious about how you think the prospects are of, you know, these kinds of deployments being the thing that sort of allows you to sort of trigger sort of global leadership in the technology.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point here. It's like what we're seeing in Europe, you know, talent is there, the capital is lagging. I think what's happening in Saudi Arabia, so the deal that's happening, you know, with NVIDIA and AMD and the US, you know, it's marking a major milestone in the rise of what we call the sovereign AI infrastructure. So Saudi Arabia here is not just buying chips, they're taking kind of a stake and they're trying to claim, you know, basically their place in the future of compute. So, and they're, you know, with, you know, the Grace Blackwell deployments, they're trying to also to commit, you know, these Arab language LLMs and nearly like, I think about 2 gigawatts of AI power on the horizon. So it's not just a regional experiment. I think it's a global power play that they're trying to play here. And I think from the US side, this is also reflecting a clear shift in the AI export strategy, which China restricted here. Saudi Arabia and the Gulf nations are emerging as their, you know, the U.S. preferred strategic partners for high-end AI. But the issue here is, you know, these sovereign AI efforts, they need not just more than just the silicon, not more than just the compute. So they'll need also the open ecosystem, the talents, the responsible development frameworks to really, truly compete. So I think we'll have to see, you know, what Saudi Arabia is doing. You know, they're getting this huge infrastructure. They're building this huge infrastructure. But I think the ecosystem and then the talent, you know, they still need to work on that.
Well, Chris, maybe I'll bring you in. I mean, because I think you were a Europe booster. And I'm kind of curious about, like, if you think you are kind of a Gulf States booster now, you know, given seeing these investments, like, you know, will they be able to bring the talent? Like, in the future, will a European researcher say, well, I could go work for a company in the US or I could go work for a company in the Gulf? Like, do you think those dynamics will start to happen as we see these deployments get bigger and bigger and bigger in, say, Saudi Arabia?
I think they already have the talent. So I've spent quite a bit of time in Saudi Arabia with a bunch of these companies, and they're heavily investing in AI. And again, even if we go back a couple of years, just after the Llama models came out, the first ones, what was the most popular model at that point? It was the Falcon models. And where do they come from? Saudi Arabia. So they already have the talent within the region, between Saudi and UAE, who have been sort of developing some of these models in region. And I think, therefore, we're going to see talent float towards that infrastructure, you know, to Volkmar's point earlier. So I think you're going to start to see stuff coming out of them. And I'm back to my earlier point. I think even with that amount of infrastructure, when you place constraints, people get more creative. So I think they're going to do interesting things. And then, again, maybe taking sort of language-first models as well, you're going to start to get different flavors as opposed to an English-first model, again, that was brought up earlier. So I think we're going to start to see different flavors of models that may have different and newer capabilities, which will become a plus to the overall world ecosystem of models. So I'm a positive on that, and I think it's a good thing.
If you look 20 years back, we had a similar kind of investment cycle. And this was affected the massive build out of internet infrastructure. So this was fiber optics in the ground, data centers, you know, computers connected. And so I think there's a certain repeat, like those nations, because they, you know, have a different investment philosophy. Like look at Singapore. Singapore made the decision, we want to be the data center hub and the fiber optic hub of that region. And they poured billions of dollars in it, and that attracted a lot of business. And I think those nations are, because of, you know, central command structure, of very, very advantaged in pushing those types of like large scale infrastructure investments out of, let's say, a sovereign wealth fund, and saying, okay, we put this capital to work. They usually are more challenged if it's a, you know, pure IP play, like, okay, we need to build some software, because, you know, then they don't have a competitive advantage. So I think they're playing to their strength here, saying, okay, we take, you know, oil money and convert it into GPUs. And thereby creating that suction sound of getting, you know, people into the region. So I think it's a very natural play for those types of like regional players of trying to establish, you know, dominance in a new emerging field, which has this, oh, and by the way, we need to put $20, $30, $40 billion down, you know, which you don't do like out of normal private, you know, funding. You need something like the US.
Right. It's like government scale.
Exactly. It's government scale. And that's exactly where they can shine. And that's where you're seeing it.
Yeah, for sure. And maybe a final question on this before we move to the next topic. I mean, Volkmar, as someone who's, you know, very much in the infrastructure game, my friend was making the argument to me recently that, you know, in some ways, actually, it's possible that, you know, Saudi Arabia might actually be advantaged even against the US on data center build out. Because of, for example, like the ability to access and move energy assets around is just something that they're not going to face the same kind of, you know, permitting issues and construction issues that you have in the US. Do you buy that as kind of advantage that they have?
No, I don't, because we have 50 states and you have, I mean, I'm moved out of California to Texas and it's totally different. Permitting is so much easier. So I think we will see a similar thing. Like, you know, they're playing it on a country level. We will play this on a regional level. And if you look at the US, there is pretty much just a network ring, which goes all through pretty much all states. And so you can put your data centers in Arizona or in Oregon or in Texas. So you go where the power is cheap for these types of build outs.
Yeah, I like that take. It's like we have Saudi, it's called Texas.
Exactly. Yeah, we also have the oil here. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, great. I'm going to move us on to our next topic, moving us a little bit away from the world of, you know, chips and national competition to something a little bit more kind of close to home. Two sort of interesting releases that happened fairly recently. One of them was from OpenAI, this benchmark they released called Health Bench, which is specifically a curated set of about 5,000 conversations, sort of interactions between AI models and users or clinicians. And the idea is to kind of create standard benchmarks for AI's use in the health domain. There's also a really interesting benchmark that came out of IBM called IT Bench, which is looking at sort of benchmarking on agents. And I guess, Kautar, maybe I'll turn it to you. I mean, I think the funny thing that I have when a new model releases now, whether it be Mistral Medium or what have you, is that they always go like, they say this, like, we're very good against all these benchmarks. And then there's a list of like 50 benchmarks. And it's like very difficult to tell what it actually means. There's like lots and lots of benchmarks, but it's like very, very difficult to say, okay, like I'm going to deploy this in the health space. You know, is this actually a good model for me? And I guess I'm kind of curious. I wanted to kind of put to you the idea that in the future, like these benchmarks might end up becoming a lot more fragmented than they are right now, right? Where you might imagine, you know, we say, oh, we're going to release a model, but it's going to be specifically for health applications. And then here are the benchmarks for it. Do you think that's where we're headed, or we're going to kind of keep developing out this ever more comprehensive benchmark suite, I suppose, for every single model that comes out?
Yeah, I think this, you know, race, you know, towards, you know, building these AI models and benchmarking against them, it's going to continue. But now that we're entering the age of agent AI, is, you know, the benchmarking, it still seems like this, you know, it's in the chatbot era. So if you want, you know, to deploy like trustworthy, for example, AI agents, I think we need new evaluations frameworks that combine general reasoning metrics with domain tasks completion. So think of it like, you know, this general benchmark tests, you know, the IQ, but, you know, sector specific ones test the job performance. So I think ultimately the future of benchmarking lies in these hybrid evaluation stacks. So general foundations models, you know, that are tested, you know, across standard reasoning tasks, but also we need to stress test, you know, in realistic operational settings, like, you know, the examples that you mentioned from OpenAI, the health bench or the IT bench, those are very specific, domain specific. And we need more of that, though. So we need, you know, kind of the general evaluation stacks and frameworks. But we also need, you know, the stress tested for these realistic and operational settings. And those will become, I think, industry standards, not because they're broad, but because they're really real. So so I think the new wave that we're seeing with the OpenAI and, you know, the IBM, you know, the OpenAI Health Bench and the IBM's IT, you know, IT agents benchmark, you know, these really are raising critical questions. Are we really measuring the right things? And, you know, as I see, you know, these models shifting from static chatbot to dynamic agents, you know, the traditional benchmarks need to change.
Yeah. What I like about that, and Chris, I'm curious about your comment on this is, you know, like, does the idea of state of the art even make sense anymore? Like, it kind of feels like, well, I don't know. It just, there's so many use cases now for AI that it'll be very difficult to imagine that one model is state of the art across all applications. And so are we kind of maturing our thinking here? Like, does it, I don't know, Chris, do you buy that? Like, state of the art, it actually doesn't make any sense because of the number of applications.
I don't think state of the art makes any sense. I think benchmarks and it's all marketing hype, isn't it? We are the greatest at this, and look, we are topping this chart here.
Yeah, you need the chart that shows that you're ahead on all the benchmarks.
Exactly. every single, even Mistral did that right. Every single model provider releases their chart, and they beat everybody else, right? And they select the models that they don't want to pit against. So it's like, I'm selecting this, 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 and this. Look, I lead on all of this, and I win at this benchmark and that one, etc. Because it's got to look like you've got the greatest model ever. And I understand that, but I truly think, don't let somebody else tell you what model is good for your use case, right? So if you need a benchmark, go create a benchmark for yourself. I'm in this domain. These are the sort of things I'm going to do. I'm going to test for it, and I'll create my own evals. And then I will make sure that I'm using that model for the purpose and task that I want. Now, don't get me wrong. Benchmarks are kind of useful in some regards because it allows you to basically go, yeah, this model's probably around the right level, and therefore I can go and try it on this different stuff. So it gives you an idea of whether it's something you're going to be useful for. But the reality is, most of us know what model is good just from using it. So I'm a viber all the way. So yeah.
Well, but yeah, Chris, when you say you create your own benchmark, isn't that like a biased approach? I mean, I can craft it in a way that's going to show, you know, my model as the best in whatever I'm doing. So there might be some bias there, as opposed to having an external party create maybe a set of benchmarks.
When I say create my own benchmark, I mean for my specific task, right? So if let's say I'm creating a chatbot for tourism that answers FAQ questions on flights, right? You may have the best coding model in the world, but if it is giving me flights for another company, then it's not really good. Or if it's not reading the FAQ, then it's not really any good, right? So like any normal software application, I'm going to want to create test cases to say, is this thing coming back with the answers that I'm expecting for my business use case? That's the kind of eval. So it's not about testing for generality. It's actually, is the model any good at the task that I want it to perform? And rather than relying on somebody else to tell you whether it's any good, go, you know, for your application you're building, go create some evals and test it out for yourself. And most of the time, back to the point, a smaller model that is fine-tuned or is, designed for a specific application will do better than a general model anyway.
Volkmar, I'm wondering if you have any predictions on where the kind of meta of this moves over time. Because I guess the world that Chris is describing, which I really agree with, is everybody sees these charts of state-of-the-art performance. And yeah, I think the main thing that I get from them now is, okay, you did your homework. You're at least as good as everyone else, right? It doesn't necessarily make me stand up and be like, wow, this is the most incredible model ever. But it just says like, you're doing as good as everyone else. If that's the case, then like we're living in a world where like these kind of marketing statements don't really have that much value anymore. And I'm kind of curious how in the future, you know, an OpenAI or a Mistral or whoever is going to kind of demonstrate that like, oh, this is the model you really should be using in the future, if not these benchmarks.
So I'm very much aligned with Chris, what he said. I think there's the outside marketing. I want to bring my product to market. I need to communicate what it does. And I think what we will see is, and this is what you get with the medical benchmark, you know, first be that, how good are you at math tests and physics tests and, you know, logic tests. And now what's happening is, as we are, you know, widening the use cases, every industry will come and say, hey, you know, I'm the medical guy and I'm, you know, the rocket ship guy. I want to know how good that model works. In the end, when you're putting things in production, you build your own regression tests, because what happens is that you have something that fails, it goes into a regression test. And then what I'm seeing with projects we are running internally here, every 6 months, you upgrade your model. So if you don't build your regression test, you actually don't know what's going to fail when you're switching from the old model to the new model, and then you have a problem with the customers behind it. And so over time, you're building effectively a benchmark. Call it benchmark, call it regression test, call it unit test, it doesn't matter. But you're building out your way of validating that A, your fine-tuned model or your, you know, the next version of the open source model you're using actually works for your use case. And if it doesn't work, you can upgrade. Right? So it's a quality assurance thing. And that quality assurance is extremely domain specific.
That's right. Yeah, it almost kind of suggests also a world where, yeah, there'll be a lot more eval work that needs to happen in-house. And then maybe finally, people have been talking about this for years, but it maybe actually finally creates a market for like specialized businesses that just do evals. Because you live in a world where basically like your big foundation model company is not going to run every single eval in the whole world. But if you have a specific use case, you need someone with eval expertise. You know, it almost kind of feels like that suddenly starts to become viable in this world as the market matures.
But I want to bring it back to Kautar's point, and I think it's really, really relevant, which is we focus on the model world. But as Kautar was saying, right, it's like in a world of agents, it's going to be less about whether this model is capable to this performing this task. It's going to be more of, is the agent capable of doing this task and how good is it performing? So I sort of agree with that point that the benchmarks kind of need to move on and sort of really look at it from a kind of agentic perspective as opposed to just always being looking at the models.
Which I think will also give a better quality because agents usually have a much more narrow band. This is the problem with the generic model, right? So I have OpenAI, it can do anything. And so how do you test that it does what you want to do specifically? But once you go to agent, you really narrow the applicability of the model or the application of the model. Because now you're saying, you agent, you do flight booking and nothing else. And now I can go deep, right? And not just broad. And right now we just go so broad. It's like a little bit of math and a little bit of medical, right? But now if you have an agent, you can actually say, do you do your task or you don't?
I'm going to move us on to our final story in the last few minutes of the episode. This is kind of a fun one. You know, on MOE, we cover, you know, infrastructure and chips and health and, you know, model evals. We don't really talk about showbiz all that much. But there was this kind of interesting story. Amazon was doing its kind of upfront event where it kind of talks to advertisers for Prime Video. It's kind of upcoming season. And there was a bunch of announcements, new shows they're doing and all the usual kind of show business stuff. But there was one interesting AI hook that was mentioned in this news story where Amazon announced that they were going to start using generative AI to create contextual advertising on Prime Video. So they didn't really provide too many details, but the idea would be that you'd be watching a show on Prime Video, an ad would come on, but it would be sort of an ad generated on the fly using AI, and in a way that's presumably contextually related to both what you're watching and what it knows about you, which is a really kind of weird, interesting change. We've had targeted advertising for many years, of course, but this seems to be a little bit of a qualitative shift where like the actual ad itself will be kind of generated on the fly. Chris, are you a fan of this? You excited about this?
I am not excited about this whatsoever. I mean, come on.
It's talking about a loaded question, but yeah, Chris, go ahead.
No, seriously. I mean, how many times on Amazon, like I look at, I don't know, maybe I buy a comb off of Amazon. And then for the next 3 weeks, I'm seeing combs appear everywhere. Every website I click on, I buy a comb. Everything I look on Amazon, do you want a comb? Here's a comb. Here's a comb. I'm like, I just bought a comb. Don't stop trying to sell me combs. The last thing I want to do is stick on the TV. There I am about to watch some New York Giants be terrible. And then guess what? More combs arrive. You're like, oh, great. Oh, no. So no, I once you can stop the combs following me around the internet, then I will be excited about Gen AI adverts.
Okay. Quick hit. Kautar, are you excited by this?
Yeah, I'm also worried about this. You know, I think, you know, this contextualized advertising might be a little too much. This also hyper-personalized advertising. I'm not sure. You know, I think we'll have to see how the viewers react to this. You know, I think we've seen clearly Chris's reaction. And also it's a machine-generated content inside the show. So yeah, I'm also a bit worried about this, you know, of this experience and how it's going to play. So I feel it's just like they're more getting into our minds and what we see. And you know, so it's a bit creepy.
And last but not least, to close out the episode, Volkmar, your take on this incredible new feature that Amazon's about to launch into our lives.
So I choose startups before I had an ed tech company. So I probably know too much about it. So there's a big challenge of creating really good creatives. And I think that is already now at a point where AI is really helping, you know, not an intern clicking together or something, but actually creating, you know, really good advertising. It's going to be really interesting to see, like, it's effectively they can now do native formats. So native formats in print is like when you have, it kind of looks, it's part of the article. And so you're reading it despite that it's an advertising. And so what you now could do is you could go full native. So you have the movie and you could even plug something. You could change the plot of the movie if you take it to an extreme, right? So it's going to be interesting to see. I want to see all the issues they have where, you know, the model accidentally renders something you shouldn't render. So how do you do quality control? But I think this is the path where we are going. You know, image rendering is obvious, but then video rendering is the next step. I think it's hopefully a long path until this becomes reality.
Hopefully, yeah, yes. We'll see. Yeah, I just envision that you're like watching Star Wars in 2030 and like Luke Skywalker's like, you should really buy a comb.
Exactly.
Like, it feels like not a good outcome for sure. Yeah, everybody remembers that one.
Yeah. So,
well, that's all the time that we have for today. Kautar, Volkmar, Chris, pleasure as always to have you on the show. This is one of my favorite kind of panels on MOE. And thanks to all you listeners for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.